You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the extended podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, I'm talking to Ed Pinsent, the second editor of the 1980s small press anthology Fast Fiction, which was a groundbreaking publication in the history of British comics. We're talking about his comic book work then and now, the processes of including work in the anthology, and the reasons it came to an end. At the end of this episode, we also have a competition to win a complete set of the small press comic, The Hunter, published by Dare Comics. So stay tuned for more details. First, though, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the programme makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
Had you been aware of the magazine and the stall that Paul Gravett ran in the Westminster Comic Marts from the beginning, or did you come to it after a couple of issues or had already seen print?
I came to it in 1982, October 1982. And I went to the Comic Mart just because I was suddenly interested in collecting comics. When I got there, without knowing it, I ran into the nascent Fast Fiction stall, and Paul Gravett was there. Now, I kind of figured I would find something like that when I got there.
Okay.
I came down from Liverpool, where I was living, to London. And you've got to remember, I'd just completed art college. I'd just come out of art college in 1982. And in my final year, I suddenly got interested in drawing comics for my own personal reasons. And I'd also been living with a chap who did homemade cassettes. He ran a label called Array's Head Cassettes in Coventry. Peter Woodin was his name. And as well as doing that, he also created and received lots of mail art, which is little photocopied zines that people were selling back and forth in the mail at that time. So I'm not saying I was in any way aware of the enormity of the cassette trading scene, which, as I've since learned, was enormous and was international and was very important post-punk development in this country. But I was familiar with the idea of photocopying things.
Well, because, I mean, I guess it's always the way when you're at art college. People are making their own little zines and exchanging them, if only within the student body, if not outside of that.
I think what you've said is true. I didn't experience it that way.
Okay.
But it was only through Pete Woodin, and the college itself didn't really know anything about that kind of work.
Oh, dear.
Sadly, they didn't really encourage it. So, yeah, turned up there, found Fast Fiction, and I think I must have picked up one of the early info sheets, as they were called. And Paul Gravett was, I think at that time he told me he set up the table as a way of meeting people. There's a social dimension to the Fast Fiction thing which never departed from it. And to begin with, I think he just sold his own comics. He had French bande dessinée and various Marvel comics and what have you, and he would put them on the table there. You had to buy a table, and people would just come up and talk to him, and, you know, isn't this interesting? And I think through that he met Phil Elliott and Eddie Campbell and various other people who were very instrumental in setting all of this up. But I know I didn't know anything about that, so I worked my way in gradually, started producing very small print runs of my own work and sending them off to Paul Gravett and saying, will you help me distribute these things? And you've got to remember, in tiny quantities this was happening, I would maybe print 5 or 10 copies.
Oh, okay. See,
it was small. Small press means small.
Right.
So, yeah, a tiny amount of copies would go off to Paul Gravett, and things grew from there.
But before you came across his stall, had you thought that zines were only to do with music rather than comics, or had there already been a sort of crossover between the two in the ones you came across with the cassette trading scene?
No. I was not aware of any kind of crossover like that. The stuff I saw through cassette trading was very arty. It was grungy photocopies of weird, obscure photographs and pictures and strange things. Nobody was doing narratives or comics or stories that I was aware of. I just thought it would stand to reason that there must be somebody doing the equivalent in the comics world. And that's what proved to be.
And so when Paul commissioned, or at least accepted the first of your strips that you'd sent to him for inclusion in Fast Fiction, I mean, was that something that you'd been hoping to work towards when you first started doing comics?
Well, just to clarify the first part of your question, he simply accepted to distribute my self-produced work at that time. He wasn't doing the magazine. There's two separate entities, you see. There's the Fast Fiction, the service, which was Paul Gravett at that time, and there's Fast Fiction, the magazine, which at that time was Phil Elliott. We haven't got to that yet. So when Paul Gravett accepted my work, I just thought, well, this is good, you know, somebody else is doing the hard work promoting and maybe even selling a few copies of my things. And what was the second part of your question? was this what I was hoping would happen? Yes. So this is exactly what I hoped would happen. As I've since learned, Paul Gravett had a much wider agenda in mind. Even in 1982, Escape magazine was on his was a part of his plans.
Right. You know, Escape magazine. More than a twinkle in his
eye. Oh yeah, definitely. It was flagged up on the very early info sheets, I think. You know, as a logo saying "Coming soon, Escape magazine."
Fantastic.
And you know, his ambitions were already embedded in that Escape project right from the start. He'd just come out of a magazine called Pissed, which had a lot of money behind it, and I think ran for 10 issues. But wasn't particularly good. But he was some form of commissioning editor, and he was not the person making it bad. It was somebody else making it bad. But, he obviously had his own plans. Yeah, so that's what I hoped would happen, and that's what did happen.
Okay.
So you got Fast Fiction, the magazine. That's the thing, as I understand it, begun by Phil Elliott. He edited and published, I think, the first 11 issues until he got tired of it. So he did it from 1982 to 1984, and he showcased his own strips, also those of Eddie Campbell, who's since become quite an important player, and he also published Ian Weeksarek, who I don't think has been heard of since, but was very, very good. And later, Phil Elliott invited me to submit some work, about 1983, I think. So I started appearing in Fast Fiction magazine. From about the fifth issue. Yes, the fifth issue. That was it.
So what was then the relationship between the magazine and the stall? The stall came first, obviously, and then did Phil just sort of browse through the titles that had been sent to Paul and think, oh, actually, I'd like to include this in the magazine?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not sure
exactly
what the relationship was, and I think you would have to speak to Phil Elliott to establish that. How these people got together in the first place and how they came to be. If I ever knew it, I'd forgotten.
Well, when he commissioned you then, I mean, what work had he seen of yours?
By 1983, I'd produced quite a few of my own small press books. They'd been going to the Fast Fiction table. He sensed new blood. I suppose he liked what he saw. I got to meet him. We seemed to get on quite well. And he said one day, you know, will you submit a couple of pieces? So, as well as being a small press, it was also, there weren't that many people involved in doing this, you've got to understand. To put it in a wider context, Fast Fiction, right at the start and through all of its life, really stood out like a sore thumb from the rest of what was going on in UK comics, I would say. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, history will judge. But I certainly felt it very keenly, even for the first time I arrived in 1982. I'm still there, fresh-faced young art student, coming down from Liverpool to London. Massive culture shock. The whole of the Westminster Comic Mart, 99% of it, is back issues of Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Collector's editions of Silver Age comics. And Jeff from Conquistador was there showing a fantastic book of Karl Barks comics, wanting £100 for this hardback reprint. Total culture shock for me, as I say, thinking, who has got £100 to spend on a lavish comic reprint like that?
So presumably then in this room full of, I won't try to engage a stereotype for what these dealers might have looked like, but certainly amongst all of these comic book dealers of traditional American comics, the guys doing the Fast Fiction stall must have seemed a bit like the strange punks in the corner.
Yes, We actually had a prime position. We went in the corner.
Good.
but I don't know how we perceived by the rest of them. Mm. I had a bloke next to me who was next stage up from a car boot salesman, as he would be now. He's a junk dealer, chancing it, trying to be an antiques dealer, selling Doctor Who jigsaws, things nice. Like this, you know. This kind of thing. We had
then as now, in fact.
Yes, absolutely nothing in common, I would say. But I guess we stood out.
And the subject matter of your early comics, I mean, what sort of things did you base them on? Because I've looked at some of the ones that you've put online, which is obviously a fairly small collection of your work, but there's a wide range of genres, you know, like the strange medical student who's working as Dr. Frankenstein, the battle between ecology and gods off-planet in Primitive,
yes.
And so
yes.
on.
That's an essay question. I'm just interested in so many things. My own personal work, I didn't even stop to think about it. I knew what I wanted to say, and characters just kept appearing to me, and methods of drawing them kept occurring to me, and ways of telling stories kept on occurring to me. Mm. I don't think I ever sat down and self-consciously thought I'm going to do something that's totally unlike comics as I know them to be.
Mm.
But that's how it turned out to be. Certainly, because I have a very idiosyncratic drawing style. My ideas are quite strange, and the way I put a story together is also very intuitive, very personal, almost dreamlike in its logic. And that's what I would hope to achieve. And so that's the thread running through all my work. I'm very close to it. It's very personal. Mm. The characters are very real to me. I've tried to be an inventor as inventive as I possibly can, and tried to be true to my own imagination, to my own vision, as I would see it. So that's what motivated me to do the stuff. And that's probably why the print runs were so small as well. I never thought for a minute anybody else would be interested in reading it, you see.
But did you see those print runs increase as you did more and more comics, as you got a reputation within... within your peers, at least?
That's a good question. Yeah, they did increase slightly.
Okay.
Yes. Again, I'm not going to make any vast claims for this, and I haven't got accurate records. I think, as I say, eventually I took over Fast Fiction magazine, for example, which could conveniently be called a flagship compilation of the best of UK small press. I think I went to 100 copies on that one.
Okay.
But I never went to 500 or even 1,000,
right.
Certainly not. So, as I say, you know, we're talking very small quantities. Indeed. But as my reputation, for want of a better word, got around, yes, I think the print runs did go up slightly.
Mm. I mean, because I suppose through the lens of history, looking at Fast Fiction's growing reputation via, new generation of small press creators through references in the internet and so on, I guess looking back at it now, we just expected everything would have sold in much larger quantities than you're saying they did, you know.
Perhaps that would be the expectation. I think the cultural significance is not diminished by that.
Mm.
And you could say perhaps we were, you know, just selling these exciting and vibrant comics to a small range of people. But I don't think that really matters. I mean, personally, my view is that's not how I measure success in the first place. I measure success by the impact that I have on a reader.
Mm.
And I don't think that can be gauged in terms of sales. And it may sound like I'm trying to justify being this poet working in a garret or something like that. But then on the other hand, you know, I think this stuff finds its own level. Mm. I mean, work also got published in Escape magazine, and that had a much higher print run, and people accepted it there as well. Indeed, that's how most people know me and the other Fast Fiction artists, is through Escape, which reached an international audience, not just people who attended Westminster Comic Marts or bought stuff off the mail order service. And the same happened to a certain degree with a later venture called Gag Comics and other titles published by Harrier Publishing.
Mm.
And that was something Phil Elliott's initiated and managed quite very well in the later 1980s.
Mm.
And it was at the time of the so-called black and white boom period, which you have probably heard about. I think it was a great thing and then turned out to be a terrible disaster. I think it was happening in America, where you could sell black and white comics directly to stores who have no chance of returning them because of the strange distribution system.
Yeah, the direct market.
Yes, direct market, that's it, thank you. a direct market. So as a result, comics achieved a kind of saturation, or certain kinds of hand-drawn photocopy comics achieved a kind of saturation they wouldn't have got before. But yeah, Harrier Comics tried to take advantage of that situation and followed the same route. You know, a dummy was produced, that was sent to the distributors, pre-orders were taken on the strength of that dummy, and a print run would match the orders was produced.
Cool.
So again, you know, you saw in the pages of Gag and other titles, there were at least 5 issues of Paris, A Man of Plaster by Glenn Dakin, for example, which sold through Harrier. And they reprinted sometimes work which had already been done as a small press zine or which had already appeared in Fast Fiction.
Well, because I noticed that with some of your work, that it's been printed at least 3 times now, once in its small press form, then again in somewhere like Escape, and now digitally.
Yes. Yeah, I keep trying until somebody gets it. I'm not proud. I mean, there's no money involved. It's not as if I'm being paid 3 times over. And yeah, I think I like to take advantage of these formats. I mean, there's something I've always wanted to say. You see, you could look at the situation and say, why did small press take off in the first place? And I think it's because photocopying suddenly became good, and it suddenly became cheap, and it suddenly became widely available. You know, you got your Rank Xerox shops and your Prontoprint springing up in the 80s, all over the place. And people figured out how they could put together a small press zine. They figured out they could make a photocopier print both sides of a piece of paper. All of these analog decisions have to be made. And, you know, we're able to produce stuff in a way which, you know, we hadn't done before. And if you've seen photocopies from the 1970s, they're really bad.
Yeah.
And smeary. And
so it was more, it wasn't so much the technology becoming available, it was the technology being improved to the extent that it could be used for a product like that.
Yes, I would say so. And I'm not saying that accounts for everything, but it does account for a lot of things.
And then, and I suppose that would also be why the small press scene in Britain had a lag behind the small press scene in America, because in America, a lot of the small press comics were printed by poster shops.
That's right.
Where it was easy, you know, and in fact, a lot of the people who made these small press comics worked in those shops and so used, you know, the facilities that railed for them. While over here, it was more, you know, the birth of the photocopier rather than, you know, your mate who works in a printing press.
Yes, I think that's a very accurate statement, a very accurate summation of what happened in America. And I think generally in America, things like printing were more socialised than they are in this country, shall we say. And even to this day, digital printing on a professional scale does remain quite prohibitively costly. And people don't want to help you to do it right. And it's there's nothing like taking something in your own hands and putting it on the bed of a photocopier and working out how to get a result from it. If we could have had our own photocopiers on our desks, we would have been made for life. But you see what I mean? When you go and see a printer, you know, unless he's very sympathetic to your cause, he's not going to explain to you about things like paper stocks or card stocks and how you can do free colour process printing cheaply. Unless you're very lucky. So, as I say, it was mastering and understanding those technologies. I mean, Phil and Eddie could happily talk about this subject till the cows come home. Eddie Campbell used to like the effect of photocopying that it had on his Lettratone, for example. Lettratone is, again, another very analogue technique, which it's no longer available anymore. You can reproduce something like it on a computer. But it's brilliant stuff. It's a thin plastic film with adhesive backing, which you stick directly on your artwork and cut away with a craft knife. And when photocopied, it produced unusual and unexpected effects, which Eddie Campbell enjoyed.
Well, I was wondering, actually, about the there does seem to be a sort of art style that you recognise with 80s small press comics. Thick lines, perhaps, a sense of design that maybe also comes from the birth of style magazines and music magazines. But I wonder, the sort of the thickness of the line and the clarity of the line, that came from the fact that it needed to be photocopied, and so your art had to kind of be sympathetic with the technology that you used.
I've never thought of it like that. That's a very good observation. That's very good. Yeah, I think that does account for it. I think without knowing it, we opted for what would be seen as a professional route. And Hunt Emerson, who was a professional, said he always drew with a brush because he's thinking all the time, how is it going to be reproduced by photomechanical transfer? But to open up your question slightly, I think You know, the sheer variety and range of art styles and indeed storytelling styles and comic styles and ideas that I've experienced through fast fiction has never ceased to amaze me.
Mm.
And I have over there within reach my folder of info sheets. But we don't have to look at it right now. It doesn't work very well on the air. But I haven't browsed it for a long time, but there's a lot of stuff. And I was always impressed by how different it was. It really was a genuine alternative. Mm. And quite often the ideas were very strong indeed. They were coming at me from all over the UK, as if out of nowhere. Mm. They weren't all the same. There were sometimes influences that you could spot between each other. But for the most part, you know, I was always struck by the sheer originality of somebody's idea. It's almost as though it had gone straight from their head onto the piece of paper and into the photocopied zine. And when it succeeded, I was just flabbergasted. I thought, you know, a miracle has taken place, and this is something I want to promote and be associated with. That's why I put so much energy into editing the Fast Fiction magazine, but also running the Fast Fiction service, which I did for 3 years. You know, I put a tremendous amount of time and effort into trying to not sell, but to distribute and make visible this work.
Mm.
And again, because it was such small quantities, we keep coming back to that, perhaps the impact on the culture was not massive. But I like to think it does make a difference.
Mm.
It's an alternative to what we get bombarded with and what gets foisted upon us, whether we like it or not, in the general run of culture, not just in comics, I think in everything, in television, movies, advertising, magazines and what have you.
Mm.
I think I fought it then in the 80s, and I think it even more so now. But what's on offer and what's made available to us is a very narrow range of culture. Extremely narrow range of culture, determined purely by what people think will sell, and what people think will sell is more of the same. So through Fast Fiction, it seemed to be a playground where that didn't apply, and almost anything was possible, and that people could, no matter how bizarre their imagination, could express it on paper, and through Fast Fiction, stand a chance of at least 10 other people seeing it. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
I'm very pleased about that, and I can't take any credit for it. It's the people who produced the work, gave it the energy and the power for that to happen.
And when you took over the magazine, I guess the mechanisms then were already in place for people submitting work to possibly be published and for the distribution of the next issue to come out. And so I guess that gave you a certain amount of freedom, if not to so much stamp your own identity on the magazine, but to keep it going and then have a chance to look at what was out there rather than starting from scratch, which might have been a more daunting task.
It would have been daunting starting from scratch, but I stamped my identity on it right from the start.
How is your vision different?
I like to think I'm an easygoing person, but I also have a tremendous ego. And when I know how I want to do something, then nothing stands in my way. Yes, there were mechanisms in place, but people did not submit work to me. I went to them.
Oh, okay.
I approached people whose work I liked.
Mm.
I wrote them a letter. This is all pre-internet, don't forget. No emails. Wrote them a letter and said, can you send me 5 pages? I'd like what you've done in this comic, and so on. And, that's certainly the first issue I put together, number 12, was done like that. I thought, how could Phil Elliott ignore Tim Budden? How could he ignore Glenn Dakin? How could he ignore Russell Christian? Well, he didn't ignore Russell Christian. But, I had at least 5 or 6 artists who, right from the start, I thought, well, I've just got to bring them in.
Mm.
But we just can't ignore them. And I carried on doing that, and I kept on finding more people I wanted to bring in, kept on asking them for work, and was very successful about that. And as time went on, people started sending me work without being asked, out of the blue. That's how I heard about Chris Flewitt, for example, an extremely talented fellow who from Chester. And he had his own publishing imprint called Help Shark and produced some very nice, very well-presented books with lovely colour printing and gloss covers. Again, tiny little things he assembled by himself. And I immediately loved his story style. You know, he had a really distinctive drawing method, and he was very quiet and understated. Never seen anything like it in comics before or since. And his storytelling was so oblique. He had very bizarre characters. You had to read the story three times over to understand what's happening. Mm. Lots of whimsical humour. But one of many examples of the kind of talent I'm talking about. And like I say, he came to me out of the blue. I was delighted that that happened. Again, a miracle taking place, I think. And the other thing about that was the fastness. You know, a small press UK, as I've said, is small, but fast fiction was also fast.
Hence the name,
yes. And, I wanted it to be fast and accessible and easy. I wanted to carry on being as fast and accessible as easy as I possibly could. So one thing driving that is you've got your Westminster Comic Marts happening six times a year. Hmm. So you've got a deadline every 2 months where, if you can, you're going to produce your small press comic. You're certainly going to produce your info sheet advertising what's come out in the last 2 months. Hmm. And hopefully I'm going to produce another issue of Fast Fiction to go there as well. Hmm. So you've got that deadline, and so, you know, you don't have time to deliberate thinking about what's going to work and what isn't. It's got to go in. Hmm. And, you know, so it kept on coming out. The magazine kept coming out and, you know, more often than not had this fresh and exciting work in it. And the other aspect of fastness, or the accessibility at any rate, was the fact that we could distribute zines, you know, very quickly and very easily without as little mediation as possible, shall we say. If people on the Saturday of the comic fair wanted to bring me 15 copies, I would say, okay, put them on the table, we're selling them now. You know, don't come back next week and I'll think about it. Yeah, immediate, you know, immediate instant reaction. And then, you know, there's no sale or return slip they've got to fill in. Eventually they get some money from me. but you know what I mean? Generally it's just, you know, let's make this quick and accessible. Mm. You know, you print these things up, let's get them out while they're fresh. And I would say, you know, perhaps some would say, well, I say it at any rate, that element of spontaneity was perhaps missing from the way Escape happened, which, you know, only came out once a year or maybe even less often. Mm. And they had plenty of time to deliberate over what strips should go in and what shouldn't. And they had so many conflicting priorities that the choice of strips sometimes ended up a little bit stilted. Mm. I would like to say, compared to the rich spontaneity of Fast Fiction, at any rate. but there you go.
Well, I don't want to open up a debate about the rival publication.
Not at all. No. Paul Gravett is a wonderful chap, you know, and what he did with Escape was totally unique. Never been anything like it in comics or in magazines, I would say. Mm. It's an extraordinary work, a tremendous achievement that he should be proud of. Mm. And like I say, it still resonates today. I think it's was responsible for bringing work to a wider audience. And yeah, he did have a very distinctive vision, just different to my own.
Was the how long did the store keep running in relation to the magazine? Were you running both, or were they still two very separate entities?
No, one time I was doing everything.
Right.
Okay, how did this happen? Let's see. Yeah, Paul Gravett was doing the service in the stall up until 1987, I think, when he'd had enough of it, and I took it over then. Mm. And I'd not long moved to London, so he selected me as being the best possible choice to take it over. And the magazine I'd taken over in 1984 from Phil Elliott, like I say. Mm. So, yeah, you've got a period where they're both running tandem, hand in glove, in a quite incestuous way, perhaps. But, yeah, they were running together. And it eventually all stopped in 1990. And the main reason I stopped is I'd just won a place on a archival training course. And
real life got in the way.
Yes, real life suddenly got in the way. And I just thought, well, this is quite demanding doing what I'm doing already. I'm trying to publish my own work, trying to draw my own comics. I'm trying to sell Fast Fiction magazine. And I've got my living room full of boxes of small press comics I'm trying to sell and distribute by mail order and at Comic Marts, and I'm holding down a full-time job. Now, how am I going to do that and study for this course at the same time? Mm. So I thought something had to give. Perhaps it was a bad decision. I shall never know. But things were getting a little bit stale as well, so I thought it was probably time to move on. Mm. And so that's what I did.
I mean, by that time, in the early 90s, I don't know the chronology of the opening of more esoteric comic shops in London, but was there now the likes of Gosh and Comic Showcase, where in fact you could find small press comics in a regular comic shop, or hadn't that actually started to happen yet?
That did happen, yes. That's a good point. It's a dimension I sometimes overlook. Yes, we did manage to get small press into shops like Forbidden Planet and Gosh Comics and Comic Showcase, and also a place called Meanwhile, which had a short life. It was in Camden Town, very well placed, very near the station, very prominent, and was like a boutique. It was very friendly and lively. It had a kind of, I think they had a metal robot in the window, and it was meant to look like a sort of French bande dessinée salon of some sort. And the owners wore Hawaiian shirts on the opening day. And,
nice.
But yeah, the chap there did support small press comics in a financial way, and certainly put them on display and helped me out to a degree. The story turned out badly, but I'm not going to get into that at this time.
Okay. But you did continue to make small press comics, though, throughout the 90s?
Oh, yeah, I did a bit. It started to tail off a bit then, yes. I slowed down personally. I wasn't drawing as much. At one point, I even gave up drawing comics. I don't have anything more to say. And it just became harder and harder to actually get a project going for some reason. It wasn't for lack of outlets. I mean, there was Zum, for example, which that was done by my friend Luke Walsh in Liverpool with Mike Kidson for a time. And that was, again, a kind of distribution service. I directly helped Luke Walsh. I gave him a lot of information, a lot of ways he could help initiate that service, not to replicate Fast Fiction, but to do similar things to it. And he did it by publishing a regular, big, fat A5 bulletin of stuff, which was packed with reviews and addresses. And I don't think he sold the stuff so much. He didn't act as a central distribution point, but just told you that it was where it existed and where you could get hold of it yourself, which was a very good business model. So I was able to get my work in there for a time, and I even contributed some reviews to Zum. And after that, there was Caption. But I never really got on with Caption very well, and I didn't find it a very effective way of selling stuff, certainly. And there was also Peter Pavement. He was, again, doing a very good job. He was, he sold small press stuff, but he didn't limit himself to comics. He had a lot of fine art things, screen-printed luxury art books of one kind or another, and he dabbled in the weirder end of the market, as it were. I think even selling some slightly political and subversive things. And he travelled around a lot. He had transport, so he was able to take the materials to different places. For a time was a very successful distributor and a publishing imprint, and he published some of my work as well.
Okay.
He published Saga of the Scroll, for example. It was very nice of him. Things kind of tailed off, and it wasn't the same.
And now for, I think, over a decade, you've worked on the Sound Projector magazine.
That's right.
A growing interest in music coinciding with your dissatisfaction with comics? Or?
Yeah, I often ask myself the same question. It was a kind of eureka moment. In 1995, my friend Harley Richardson just suggested it to me out of the blue. I think we were waiting to see Sonic Youth. Went into a pub in Kentish Town or something, and I don't know, had a conversation turned to producing music zines, and he just said, you should do your own music zine. And as soon as he said it, I could just see the Sound Projector just appeared before me. I thought, yes, I could do that, and I know exactly what it would look like, and I know what the content would be, and it was a vision fell upon me. And I just had to go and make it happen, and that's exactly what did take place. But I tried to remain true to my small press principles with it. Except I took things up a notch, because I printed 500 copies of the Sound Projector and have done so ever since, and there's been a lot more interest in it, and not because it's Ed Pinson, but because it's music. And that stands to reason, and it's much easier to understand somebody writing about music than it is to understand my unfathomably strange comics. Which are,
but you still contribute illustrations to Sound Projector, though.
Yes, that's right.
At least
it gives
you an artistic outlet.
Yes, that's right. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'd hate it if I stopped drawing altogether, but it's even harder to find the time now to do so.
Yes. Is there any sequential art in the magazine or just illustrations to go with the articles?
Oh, it's just drawings. They're not even illustrations. Mm. I know they're drawings that are totally independent of what I write, and I just slot them in afterwards at the 11th hour when I'm putting the magazine together. So they're not an illustration. They're not bringing anything out of the text. Mm. They're just kind of appliqued on. But yeah, it's a quite different thing because I've... yes, it's probably a subject for another interview, but I evolved a very strange drawing technique, which I'm very pleased about. In fact, I won't reveal which secret. I'll do a workshop around it one day.
but something that perhaps was less suited then to drawing comics with.
Oh, yeah, because it was far too associative and intuitive. But, because when I'm doing a comic, you know, more things have to be planned. You know, a tremendous amount of spontaneity goes into it, but then I'm always thinking about how to structure it the whole time and, shape it into a way that will make sense as a story and then something that will make sense as panels on a page. Mm. All the things which regular comic artists do, I suppose.
Mm. And in terms of your comics, there's comics.edpinsent.com.
That's right.
Which is a fairly recent venture. In fact, it went online on my birthday.
Good timing.
What was the genesis of that? Was it people actually were starting to get an interest in your former work and you realised that you should have a web presence?
Or
a desire to do new work as well?
It's many things. I don't think there's been the interest. No, I just did it out of vanity, I suppose. there was a website before, soundprojectordemon.co.uk, which did have comics on and sold comics through it and so on. Because it's... my account reached a certain limit beyond which I couldn't upload anything anymore. So the recent development is that I now have a much more generous hosting plan. Mm. And I've also learned since about how to use things like WordPress. Mm. And I've also learned how to use some Web 2 applications like Scribd, or Scribd, as they call it. And that's an interesting development because you can upload a PDF of your comic to Scribd. They'll do the business of hosting it, and they'll stream it in a way that makes the PDF display interestingly. Okay. So all you've got to do is put a link into your site, and they're doing all the work.
What, in a similar kind of altruistic way, like archive.org?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, thank God for the internet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. These developments are happening all the time. And the difference is with archive.org is I don't think they serve up the resources very well.
No.
If you've tried to access, there's a lot of tremendous, interesting audio material there, and also books and probably some comics as well. But it's hard to find, and then it's hard, they don't render it very well.
Mm. People may be listening to this right now on archive.org.
Yes. Well, cut that bit out. I don't think they would deny that, because that's not the function of archive.org. The function is to archive the internet. It just so happens they offer a very nice hosting plan where you can for free, as long as you are prepared to distribute your work for nothing, you can host a lot of material.
But Scribd Scribd is some sort of free altruistic service for small press comics.
It's for anything that's a publication.
Okay.
People put anything and everything up there. Books, magazines, one-page articles, schoolwork, things about President Obama. And it's enormous. They're just dedicated simply to things that can be rendered as PDFs or documents.
Okay.
Like Flickr is simply photographs, and YouTube is streaming video, whatever. So Scribd does that. Another thing which small press people are aware of and have used, of course, is Lulu.com, which offers something similar, except money is involved.
Mm.
So I think you can open an account for free, and you put your resource up there, and then the consumer has a choice of buying a paper copy, which gets printed on demand and bound up, or they can buy a download.
Mm.
And that's good as well. And I know Chris Reynolds, another exceptional small press talent, whose work I admire enormously, he's used Lulu.com to great effect.
Hmm. And then, in a way, although there are many people out there making webcomics and using all sorts of different interfaces, the arrival of new versions of the internet like Scribd and WordPress, which make it a lot easier for amateurs to put their work onto the internet, you could almost create a parallel with the early 80s comic scene again. It's almost like the advent of the photocopier.
Exactly.
It's an easy piece of technology that lets people get their product to the public.
Which is as it should be, I would say. Yes, exactly. I think you put your finger on it there. You know, I've said before about the accessibility and the ease of access that fast fiction tried to offer. Mm. And I think now, you know, with Web 2 applications, the internet is going that way as well, and that can only be a good thing. Mm. It's going to result in a proliferation of material. I don't know if it's all going to be worth reading, but, you know, the point is to get the tools in the hands of people. And it's a good thing, because, you know, to build a website before, you had to have Dreamweaver, you had to know HTML.
Well, even MySpace, I found that infathomable.
Yes, whereas WordPress now, you know, somebody else has written the code, and they put in GUIs to make it as simple as they possibly can. Mm. You can use it out of the box immediately, and it's getting more and more sophisticated. Like I say, I personally have used a plugin to handle ways of displaying covers slightly more interestingly, but there's probably even better developments in the pipeline. Mm. It's a good thing.
And now that you have this specific comic-orientated website, does that mean we'll be seeing new work from you up there?
I will try. I sense that it's very much a snapshot of history at the moment, and I don't know if things are going to get any better. We'll have to see. And it so happens I have drawn a comic strip this year, so signs aren't too bad. And I hope to complete it quite soon. I was writing and drawing it over Easter, but suddenly an idea for something occurred to me, and enough to make me want to actually get on and draw it again. So very pleased about that, but I can't say that I'll be as prolific as I used to be when I was younger.
Sure.
Sadly.
I'll look forward to seeing it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
For more info about Ed's comics and the history of fast fiction, please visit his website at comics.edpinsent.com. And if you'd like to read about the history of the Stall and periodical, there's an account of those years from Eddie Campbell's point of view in the book How to Be an Artist, which you can find in all good second-hand bookshops and in the complete Alec omnibus, which comes out in September. While we're on the subject of small press comics, Dare Comics writer Adam Hamdy has given us a complete set of his comic The Hunter to give away as part of the celebration of the printing of the final issue. To win a set, email us on backprojection@hotmail.com, that's backprojection@hotmail.com, with the answer to the following question. What's the name of Dare Comics' next title? You can find out that by visiting darecomics.com or recalling the name of Giuseppe Tornatore's 1995 film about the golden age of cinema. Next Wednesday is the start of this year's Sci-Fi London Film Festival, and I'll be hosting three comic book-related events at the festival. A Q&A with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen co-creator Kevin O'Neill on Thursday the 30th at 9 p.m. A Q&A with Delicatessen and City of Lost Children co-director and also Bande Dessinée creator Mark Caro on Friday the 1st of May at 9 p.m. and hosting a panel on Can Comics Be Classified as Sci-Fi Literature with Pauls Cornell and Duffield, Brian Talbot and Daniel Merlin Goodbury, which is on Saturday the 2nd of May at 2:30 p.m. More info on all of those can be found at www.sci-fi-london.com and on our blog www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.